Hello.
I hear you.
It's good. I hear you too. It's recording. How you doing?
I'm good. How are
What are
you?
you doing waking up at 10 o'clock in the morning?
This is what time I wake up every day.
It's a good life. So let me introduce you to everybody. We're here with Gabe Wax, who is a producer extraordinaire. Gabe, I'm gonna read a little bit of your bio. You can tell me what's right and what's wrong, or you can add to it.
Okay.
But Gabe, over the last decade, has had his hand in some of the most critically acclaimed albums. From Cass McCombs to Deer Hunter to The War on Drugs to White Oak, I recognize that you all. This is the only name I recognize here, but you've worked with Beirut. Do you want to add
Yeah.
anything?
Like what?
Like, I
Like
don't know.
just
Like,
records that I did?
sure, but you've also done. You had your own record, and you also won a Grammy, right?
It's true. Yeah. The War on Drugs record won a Grammy, and then I also make music under my own name. I play with people, but yeah, producing is definitely like my job.
What's your album called?
It's called Really 67 Others.
It's a great title. I listened to it this summer and I left you a WhatsApp message saying that I was so impressed. I don't
You
know.
did. It was really sweet.
Well,
It was really
it was so
sweet.
good. The thing is, I don't know if it's a compliment or not. I don't know if this is what you're going for, but it really reminded me of a Kid A from Radiohead. I don't know if you like that
For sure.
comparison.
No, I mean, that's what, I'm 26, so that was like a really formative record for me growing up, for sure. So,
Yeah.
yeah, no, that's a huge compliment.
Good, good. So today I'd like to talk to you about the economics of the music industry. And when I sent you a message about that, you wrote back saying there's money in the music industry. So I understand that there's less money than there was in the 90s. Maybe you could talk about why that is. Maybe it's just like two words, maybe it's just like the internet. But tell me what's happened since the 90s.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of things have happened, but mainly people just don't buy records or consume music in the ways that they used to. And like the people that are in control of that, record labels, managers, everyone basically for the past, 15 years has been scrambling to try to figure out like how to fix that and how to monetize that model. It's just making money. They just have to figure out how to sell a product that people like were essentially stealing for, years.
Well, how is there any money then if people are just stealing the content?
Well, you can go on tour. That's how a lot of people make money these days. You can sell your song, if they use your song in a movie, if they use it in a commercial, they're certainly not going to steal that, most of the time. So, and then, streaming has become a big, like the closest thing to replacing record sales that we've come to. And for a lot of people, I think has eased the market a little bit.
Well, so for example, like Spotify.
Spotify, Apple
Well,
Music,
let's say that somebody streams you on Spotify. How much money are you making, and how much money is the you're the producer, so are you making any money as the producer?
I only make money if I get a point on the record, so that's like a percentage, 1% of like a percentage point. And that happens less and less these days, I would say, because people do want to make as much as they can off of their music. If I have writing credit on a song, I'm certainly get a point. Producers do still get points on records, and big producers for sure still do. I do sometimes, but when people are, I do a lot of bands' first records sometimes when they're just starting out. I feel like sometimes it's a little bit, I feel a little weird about it sometimes personally.
Wait, making money from the work you're doing?
Well, it's like my work is to make the record, but then it's their song, and that's the property that's what people come back to. There's this really famous producer, Steve Albini. He did a lot of Nirvana records and Pixies and lots of people, and he never takes points. He's never, ever, ever taken points, even in the 90s when he could have been making, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So you're
And
making
he's.
all of your money in the studio for the studio time.
Yeah. That was his philosophy. It was like, I am hired to do a job. And my job starts and ends when we make the record. And beyond that, like it's your money to keep. But I definitely don't like I don't have an ethos about it like that. I it's a case by case basis.
So when you're in the studio, are you making less than you would have made in the 1990s if you were a producer doing the same
kind of albums? Oh my God, I would be rich if I were a producer. The level that I'm at, if we were in the 90s, I would be much richer for sure.
Okay, but yeah. Is it still a middle class job, or are you in the 5%?
Yeah, I would say it's a middle class job if you're successful, you know. There's still money to be made, and it's certainly got a lot better. I started working in studios when I was 19, so 7 years ago. And in those 7 years, as I've also just gotten more successful, but also I've seen more money come into the music industry, and like it's a little bit less frantic now. People okay. are making money,
and that's because they figured out a way to monetize things like Spotify. Do people make money off of YouTube?
Yeah, for sure. But you know, it depends. I mean, Spotify, you get about a tenth of a cent per play, I think. Mm-hmm. So like, you really have to be doing some good numbers to make money off Spotify.
Okay, so like, let's talk about Beirut, because that's the one band I know. I don't know anything about music. Is Beirut the biggest band that you've worked with?
Probably in terms of like worldwide sales and acclaim, for sure. Okay. And from an economics perspective.
Okay. And so is Beirut, how much money, and it can be ballpark, but how much money sure. are they making from the streaming? And then how much money are they making when they go on tour? Are they making a lot more from tours?
They would probably, you know, that's a good question. A band like them would probably get pretty good guarantees. So like once you reach a certain level, you get a guarantee from promoters or venues where they'll just be like, we know that you're famous, so we're going to just give you $40,000 to play this show, like, and we know the tickets will sell. You know, when you're first starting out, a lot of times like venues will do like door deals, you know, so you make money off a percentage of the tickets that are sold at the door. But you know, if you're at the level of a Beirut, you're playing like, you know, a 6,000 capacity venue, they're just going to give you the money to play the show. So they probably in total would make more in the amount of time that a tour would take. They would make more doing a tour than that time would yield them streaming, for sure.
How many days a year, or how many, I don't know how you measure it, but do you get significant downtime, or are you always working to make ends meet?
That's kind of the issue I'm having right now, is that it's tricky too, because it's like, this job is objective in some ways too, because it's like, I could do this much and the record would be done, but I hold myself to a high standard, and there's a bit of like subjectivity there where it's like, you know, I work 4 extra hours a day probably because I want things to be at a level that I want them to be at. But yeah, I work a ton. I work a lot. A normal day for me is about 10 to 11 hours. That's why I wake up at 10 o'clock in the morning, because I usually work till around 11 at night. And even beyond that, you know, I'm working on 3 or 4 records right now that, you know, most of them I've been paid for, and I'm just continuing to work on them because I, you know, it matters to me more in the end that I worked a little bit more on something and it came out amazingly.
Do you have health care?
I'm 26, so I'm about to lose it. So I'm about to hit the open market. I was actually going to do that today.
So you're not unionized then?
No, there is a musicians union, but it's not, I don't want their health care.
Okay. And yeah. What about saving for retirement? How are you doing with that?
I do that all myself. So through just like, you know, mutual funds and like personal investment. Yeah, I have just like a Fidelity account.
Is there anybody in the industry who's sort of taking you under their wing and talk to you about the sort of how to survive and how to plan for the future?
Not really, no. I think everyone, you know, the guy that I first started working for when I was 19, he was this producer from the 90s, super successful during that time, and had a really cool studio in Gowanus. You know, a lot of him taking me under his wing was telling me how he used to make $150,000 a year in 1998, and now he was lucky to be pulling in 45.
Wow.
And that's crazy to me. That was crazy, crazy, crazy to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I, now in hindsight, I mean, I think I, I, I make more than he did now. So it's like I see that there were some things that he just wasn't quite getting, mm-hmm. you know, and he was getting older. And but it is weird that like.
Well, what are some of those things?
Well, he just wasn't working with cool bands. He was doing a lot of just like day to day sessions. So like someone would just rent his studio for a day, which most of the work that I do now is like full records. So I get paid by a record label a set fee to do, you know, 3 weeks to a month of work or something, which is a much better way of getting paid because then it, the sums are larger and you can plan for the future more. The instability with this job is you know, I live completely month to month.
You started doing this – well, you started making music when you were probably 14 or 15 years old, or was it before that?
No, probably – yeah, probably – well, 12, 13, yeah.
And you were doing this mostly from your house?
Yeah, from my bedroom. It all started in my bedroom. you know, like any good American story, it starts in the home.
Yeah, well, so I was going to ask, so by the time you're 19, you're working with a pretty big producer.
Yeah.
And he was operating out of Gowanus. Does it help to have grown up in New York and be able to make those contacts? And could you have had the same kind of success if you were growing up and making music in your bedroom in Iowa?
I could have, but I probably would have had to come here at some point. I mean, there are people who do great work and have great studios all over the U.S. on smaller scales, on medium scales. But definitely, you know, it's New York. It's more expensive, but I also make more because I live here, because the labels are here and, the you know, bands want to come and be here. And there's just more bands here. Then, you know, if I lived in Phoenix, it might just be a little, I'd have to charge less probably. Mm-hmm. And there's just, it's just a different thing, you know?
But couldn't you do most of this stuff in your house, or is there a huge difference when you go to an actual studio?
No. Yeah. That's doing it at a studio is good. Cause I work with a lot of rock bands. So it's a lot of like live recording, which, you know, people do have studios in their homes, but at least in New York, you need a space, you know, there's drums and there's bass and there's guitars and it's loud and you need a lot of equipment and it, there's, you know, it requires a technical place to do your thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And also there's like certain magic around recording studios that is, unfortunately, being lost a lot in New York because a lot of the big ones, or most of the big ones, have closed. But like these rooms, you know, they really focus your mind in a way that's unbelievable. Like you can't replace that. You can't replace the interaction that happens with people in those rooms and has happened and how that stays in those rooms.
You went to Italy last year to do some recording. Who did you go with, and why did the band choose to go to this little town in the Adriatic?
That was with Beirut, actually.
Okay.
And it was because the singer had moved to Berlin, and we had done like a month in New York, and we were trying to figure out where to do next. And I think the bass player in the band had met some people from Rome, and they knew of this studio in southern Italy. And it was really cheap, and it's just, you know, it's an incredible place to be.
You think the album is better because you were there?
No.
In that location? No. It has nothing to do with it. Who are the producers that you listen to that you can just hear that they're putting in the extra work? Maybe are there three or four producers that you kind of look to and say, I'd like to be there someday?
Growing up, probably Mark Ronson was a big influence on me. He produced like Amy Winehouse's first record. Mm-hmm. Or second record, sorry. She did another one called Frank before that was amazing too. Mm-hmm. And then like his early more like hip hop stuff I really liked. And then Nigel Godrich, who did all the Radiohead records, and he's worked with Pavement a bunch and Beck. He was a big influence on me. And then a lot of hip hop producers growing up, DJ Premier, Pete Rock, J. Dilla.
Premier, for example, sounds like what he's doing is so simple. Well, what makes him extraordinary?
It's really just the sound of it. You know, it's like, it's simple, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy or like easily replicable. You know, there's something to that, like direct and simple sound that, I don't know, it just speaks to you.
And is there anybody you meet now who you're, or maybe even younger than you, who you're really impressed with?
You know, I don't get to meet enough people because I'm in the studio all the time. No, I mean, I have friends that I admire who are musicians. My friend Andrew Sarlo, he's a great producer. And he went to Berkeley, and he's working with a lot of people that he went to Berkeley with that have like become this whole little Berkeley scene, this band Big Thief. And this guy, Nick Hakim, who's a friend of mine, they're all like, they're killing it.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to college, Gabe? I don't remember.
I went to college for 1 year, and then I dropped out.
Where'd you go?
I went to CalArts near Los Angeles.
Do you ever regret dropping out?
I don't. Not for what I want to do, because this is like a trade, you know, and 4 years of private music education is really expensive, and it doesn't guarantee you anything in terms of like any job security or anything related to like moving further along in this. This is all just it's like an apprenticeship. You have to just find your place and kind of work hard and get in there and learn as much as you can, and then really it either works out or it doesn't, kind of like just based off not luck but just like getting some good chances, I think, you know, right place, right time kind of thing. We didn't get into the politics of eating.
Oh, let's do that real quick. I'll cut it in. So what are, Gabe, what are the politics of eating?
The politics of eating is that my, I eat crap. It's really bad.
Are you gaining weight?
You know, I can't really tell. I don't keep a scale, just so I can't actually know.
Okay.
And then it just becomes this weird kind of mental game of going back and forth. Sorry, I'm just trying every password into my Bitcoin wallet to try to get back. It's not working.
Don't do it while you're on the podcast.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I don't have any. Don't go looking for it. But that part is tough. The social aspect of working on records is great because you make all these friends in the music industry. That sounds so stupid. You make all these friends who make amazing music, and you get to be a part of that. But you also can't eat. I can't go out to dinner. You don't really get to do anything but record, which is great. But after like months and months of it, it's nice to just return to society sometimes.
Except when you're living in Italy, I bet you ate really well when you were doing that.
For sure. Too much, though. You know?
About when they brought the food into the studio from Italy? It probably wasn't the same as when they deliver it when you're in like a studio in Brooklyn. It was probably...
No, it was like there was this place in the town that was called like Orecchiette, and it was like a little prepared food place. And they the first days that we went there, it was like madness because we were like, oh, we're so hungry, like we have to eat. And the guy was like, okay, my friend has like a restaurant in town, let's go. So it'd be like an hour and a half of like us going there. They'd like bring out some bread, then you like get some pizza, some wine. It was just like it was not sustainable. So we found this place in town that would make us like a tray of food every day.
Wow.
For lunch and dinner. And it was insanely cheap. It was like 35 euros or something.
For the whole platter.
For the whole platter, yeah. So we would just like stick that in the oven and then just like shove it into our face. And it was really, really good.
Not eating very well in New York. And who pays for the food, by the way? Do you have to pay? Does it come out of pocket?
That's another thing. There's a lot of like, because music there aren't rules. You know what I mean? So it's like, there's only like social etiquette, but Americans don't have very good etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's not like me throwing shade at anyone. I just think like our manners are a bit whack here.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times it's just kind of free for all, you know? Sometimes there'll be a food budget if you're on like a good label or like have a good budget. And bands do pay for my food sometimes, which I'm always very appreciative of. Especially the bands that I've been working with recently, because I don't want them to hear this and be like, what the fuck, we bought him and he's complaining.